Welcome to the GBC Sermon Podcast, a weekly podcast from Gamia Baptist Church in Sydney, Australia. I'm Mark Rader, Senior Pastor here at GBC, and I'm glad you've decided to tune in this week. As we continue The Feels, our January series exploring the difference Jesus makes in our emotional life, we turn to workaholism and Chip Conley's equation for it of what are you running from over what are you living for?
Today's Bible reading comes from Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 17 to 23. It's a good one. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish, yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a person may labor with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then they must leave all they own to another who has not toiled for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labour under the sun? All their days, their work is grief and pain. Even at night, their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless.
A nice cheery reading. Don't know how many of you are feeling that way if you're heading back to work tomorrow, kind of going, yeah, I really resonate with that guy. I don't know if the teacher in Ecclesiastes was a workaholic or not, but he certainly wasn't enamored of work, at least at this point in time. We are continuing The Feels, as Jodes mentioned, and we're looking at workaholism this morning. So I don't know whether I should ask for a show of hands how many of you know a workaholic or are sitting next to a workaholic, but we won't do that. We'll just let you to self-identify over the course of the morning. This is one of Chip Conley's emotional equations, but it's a little bit different from the others that we've been looking at because workaholism is not, strictly speaking, an emotion. I've never heard someone say, in response to the question, how are you feeling, I feel workaholy today, right? Like it's a set of behaviors rather than an emotional state, but I think there's enough reason, as we'll see, to include it in something titled The Feels because of the emotion that tends to drive those behaviors as we go. Now, you're probably familiar with the term workaholism. I found out in my reading this week that it was actually a term coined, incidentally, by a pastor psychologist in 1971. And from then it entered into our vocabulary. And it entered our vocabulary as a bit of a buzzword rather than as a psychological term. So it wasn't like psychologists identified this new ism and then told us here's the word to describe it. It was a bit of a buzzword that then psychologists over the last 50 years have researched. And there's the whole bunch of work has been done in social sciences to explore what we mean when we talk about workaholism. And the American Psychological Association suggests that workaholism has three components to it. So here are the categories. You ready to self-identify? I'm not going to get you to score and stand in various places. I'll just let you do it internally, and I'll see how you scored on your face. So the first is when people feel compelled to work because of internal pressures. Now, there can be lots of internal pressures, but most of those tend to be quite negative ones. So there is an anxiety or a fear, a shame or a guilt that impels us to work. The second feature of workaholism is having persistent thoughts about work when not working. So if you are the sort of person who spends all your free time trying to figure out how you could make more time to work, that might fit you into this category. It's the incessant checking of emails at all hours of the day in case you might miss something. And the third is working beyond expectations. So whatever the expectations of your industry or your occupation, your work is where you work now, you work above and beyond all of those expectations. Researchers have found some correlations. These might not surprise you, but maybe they will. They found correlations between workaholism and type A personalities. All right, who would have thought that a driven person might end up falling into a workaholic perspective, right? Where someone who is driven by internal compulsions might be driven to talk about work all the time and never be able to set it down and all those sorts of things. They've also found correlations between those who have perfectionist tendencies and workaholism. Again, I think you can probably do the math on why that is the case. Interestingly, though, they have not found a correlation between workaholism and success, which is kind of depressing, isn't it? Because it's like, you know, if I'm going to be a workaholic, at least it'll pay off, right? Like, I'll be successful in work. And apparently, that's not the case. There's no correlation between those things. In fact, those who would say that they are workaholics or are prone to workaholism generally report lower levels of satisfaction in life in general, in their relationships, and I think we can figure out why that is, and in work. So you work more and you don't like it. That's the advantage of workaholism, right? That's where that sits. Which means, of course, that when we're talking about workaholism, it's not just a matter of kind of pointing to the person who works 70 hours a week or who checks their emails over the weekend or whatever it is and says, that's obviously workaholism. It's a little bit more nuanced than that, isn't it? Because it's quite possible, and I'm sure many of you have experienced this as I have, there can be times when work is just fun. I really love my job. I love my work. And because I love my work, I'm engaged in my work. You've probably experienced this, or at least I hope you have, right? Or else you'd be totally Ecclesiastes bound, right? That whole idea of loving your work, and therefore you're willing to put in the hard hours, you're thinking about work. And you can see how it can be fairly nuanced, can't it? What's the line between loving my work and thinking about my work consistently and becoming someone who persistently cannot turn off? You see the dilemmas that we face. So workaholism is not just a matter of kind of counting up the hours you work and adding to that the number of times that you've checked your email over the weekend and multiplying it by something. It's actually a lot more complicated than that. And I think it's the compulsions behind those behaviors that make this a worthwhile topic for the fields. And Chip Conley's equation, which is up on the screen here, I think really points to that, right? That workaholism is, what are you running from over what are you living for? And if what we're living for is bigger and more significant than what we're running from, then workaholism or the tendencies and behaviors of workaholism will shrink. And if what we're running from is bigger and bigger than what we're living for, then the opposite will happen. But here's the thing that I'm not sure if I discovered it. Here's the thing I observed when I was doing my reading. Never done a lot of thinking about workaholism, to tell you the truth. Never done any reading on it. I just kind of knew the term. But when I began this week to do some of my reading, to read articles and blog entries and all that kind of stuff, try to get my head around this, I came at them with this equation in mind. So in all the things that I was reading, I was asking myself, what does this tell me about what people who tend to be workaholics, what does this tell me about what they're running from or what they're living for? And I'm like, what am I going to find here? And at the end of the week, when I kind of compiled all of my notes and had a look at all the stuff that I'd discovered, it occurred to me that one of the central features of workaholism is actually anxiety and fear. But what I also observed was that you can end up having fear and anxiety both above the line and below the line. So let me explain. Here are some of the standout fears that I encountered in my reading that lead to the behaviors or contribute to the behaviors of workaholism. So the first, fear of being a failure, right? I'm not sure how many of you have ever had that fear. I am reasonably familiar with that one, right? The fear of being perceived as a failure or feeling like I actually am a failure, that I haven't achieved what I thought I could or I haven't achieved what others thought that I should or I didn't do a good enough job, whatever it might be, the fear of failure. And you can see how that drives workaholism, right? I'm fearful of being a failure and therefore I work harder and harder and harder trying to make sure that people don't perceive me as I fear that they probably will. But you can actually flip that around. And instead of saying it negatively, I am afraid of failure and that's why I work so hard, we can say it positively, can't we? And what we end up saying is, I am living for success or achievement. I'm living for achievement, and so I am working hard to achieve my goals. Doesn't that sound positive and upbeat? But it's still driven by the fear of being a failure, isn't it? I'm trying to achieve because I'm masking a deeper fear. Or consider the fear of being considered a nobody, right? Because busy people are important people, aren't they? Or important people are busy people, or whatever it is. And so if you ask me, hey, are you busy? And I say, no, not at all. What does that say about me? I mean, I must be a complete loser if I'm not busy. Now, again, we don't say that out loud, but isn't that part of what drives our scheduling, right? I need to be busy because then I'm really doing well. Yeah, I'm flat out here. I am just so busy. I'm so important. Man, let me tell you. Now, we can flip that again, and we can say that what we're living for is actually for status, or we're living for that kind of that sense of importance. Now, we might not say that out loud because it sounds a little bit arrogant, but that can be end up being our positive expression that simply masks our fear. Or the third that I encountered, which was the fear of being found out. You've heard of the imposter syndrome, right? The sneaky suspicion that if anybody scratches the surface of my life too hard, they're going to see the horrible truth, that I have no idea what I'm doing. All right, I'm asking for a friend. You've all experienced that, right? And that fear of being found out, of being exposed, that we don't know as much as we purport to know, or we don't know as much as people even think that we might know, can lead us to work harder. I may not be competent, but I can work really hard. Now, positively, we can talk about that as living to kind of prove ourselves, to prove our worth to the organization or to the company or even to ourselves. But in both cases, what you end up with is fear above and below the line, one spoken of negatively and one spoken of positively. And I'm no mathematician, but that doesn't sound like it's going to decrease workaholism at all. If we're going to actually change workaholism using this equation, then what we need is something much more significant in the denominator, below the line, right? We need something big enough to live for in order that what we are afraid of begins to shrink, and therefore our tendencies to overwork may shrink as well. You with me so far? Okay, so if it's this fear and this sense of almost shame, it seems to me that it's pointing to our identity as one of the most critical things for us to consider in relationship to work. Right? Did you notice how I framed up those fears? But they were the fears of being a failure, about being nobody, about being found out. Right? There's a sense of our identity that's wrapped up too often, too closely in our work. And this is where I think the Bible has something to say for us. Now, the Bible doesn't say much about work, to tell you the truth. Most of what the Bible has to say in terms of practical tips for work are found in the book of Proverbs. Not that surprising. It's a book about how to be successful. And so you find lots of Proverbs that say things like this: work hard and you'll be successful. If you're a lazy git, you will not be. That's kind of the summary of proverbial wisdom on work. Do the right things at the right time. Don't put off till tomorrow what should be done today, and you'll probably be successful. That's generally what you get. But in terms of more helpful for us, we actually need to probably construct a bit of a theology of work. And the theology, one of the best descriptions I've heard of it is where our thinking about God intersects our real life. If all we do in our theology is we have big thoughts about God, I think that's philosophy, right? If all we do is live our life, that's just living our life. A good theology is where what we think and believe about God and about Jesus intersects our real life. And so when we think about work, what is it that we believe about God that impacts our understanding of work and its place in our lives? And to do that, we probably need to turn instead to the opening chapters of the Bible in Genesis. So if you have your Bibles and want to have a quick look, you'll probably be familiar with the story nonetheless. It's the story of creation, the two different tablets of creation, the two slightly different accounts of how God created the world. If you have a look in chapter 2, verse 15, We're told that God has created man. He's created the Adam, and he has also planted a garden. And in chapter 2, verse 15, we read this. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. He put the man in the garden to work it and to take care of it. A little bit later on, he creates a woman and gives her to the man as a companion. And we assume that she had the same task that Adam did, that the two of them were set to the work of working and caring for the garden. Here's the important thing to note. This happened before the fall. Why is that important? Well, it means that work is not a consequence of sin. Work is actually built into who we have been created to be. Isn't that nice? I don't know what Adam and Eve got up to in the garden. I have no idea what working and caring for the garden looked like. If you see my garden at home, you'll know that I don't know what that means. But we don't get to hear too much of it. But can I just say, it probably wasn't long walks on the beach and shuffleboard every afternoon. We were not created solely for recreation and rest. We were created to work. There is no retirement, really, when it comes to the work that God has given to us, because that's to deny who we've been created to be. It's only after the fall that things change. In chapter 3, when there are the consequences of their foolish action in taking the fruit, God says these words to Adam in verse 17 and following. He says, "Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken." And while there is there's still fertility in the soil, what's changed is that now there will be frustration in your work. Anyone experienced the consequences of the fall in their workplaces at some point in time? Right? There is frustration in work. There is the metaphorical equivalent of thorns and thistles in our lives. And yes, we still eke out a living, and yes, there are still those moments of satisfaction and contentment, but boy, oh boy, we get Ecclesiastes, don't we? I mean, I might not hate my work because I might leave it to someone who's going to just undo it all, but I get this, don't I? Don't I? Yes, I do. Do you? Right? That whole idea just kind of going, what's the point? This is so frustrating. This is so meaningless. What am I actually achieving? That's the consequence of the fall. But whenever you have one of those days that you come home and you say, you know what, I am tired, but I have done a good day's work. That is part of the created good. Because that's how God has wired us. Now, it's interesting, in Genesis chapter 1, we're given a slightly different account, right? It's a different way of describing the creation of the world. And what we find there is there's no reference to work, at least in relationship to humanity. Instead, we find in chapter 1, verses 26 and 27, that when God creates humanity, he creates them, male and female, in his image. And scholars have had all sorts of debates about what it means to be in the image of God, but can I just suggest that if you had started the Bible in Genesis 1, verse 1, and had only read to verse 27, and I stopped you and said, tell me, from what you have read, what is the image of God? You know what we would be left to assume about God, if that's all we had? Is that God is very powerful, but he is a creative, working God. We don't hear about his holiness in chapter 1. We don't hear about his righteousness in chapter 1. What do we hear about? We hear about his creative work in bringing all that we know into existence. And here's the second thing that we're told. God, on the seventh day, ceased his work. So work as a whole was given to humanity as a gift from God. Adam was created, Eve was created, they were given work as part of the good gift of God, and they were given rest and recreation. Six parts to one. That might be a helpful formula for our lives, right? And then we are told that we are created not as workers per se, but in the image of God. And I think this is where it becomes so significant for us moving forward. You see, work and the satisfaction that comes from it is certainly a gift of God to each of us, but work is not the source of our identity, and it cannot be. Work will never bear the weight of providing you or I with our identity, and here's why. Because work was never designed to take that kind of weight. Because work is not the ultimate reason why we have been created. Why did God create you? Why did God form you precisely as you are? It wasn't just so you'd be a better worker, is it? Our work cannot provide us with identity because work is not our primary why. You and I have been created for relationship with God and with others and with the world around us. That why leads to a very different approach to work. Because if we go to work hoping to draw out of our occupation significance and worth and meaning and value, we will be empty every time. We have to bring significance and worth and value and meaning to work. Which is a very different proposition altogether, isn't it? If I know, before I step through the doors of my office on a Monday morning, if I know that I have significance and I have worth and I have value and I have meaning because I've been created by God and am loved by Him and have been swept up in His grand plan in Christ to restore and renew all things and have been given His Holy Spirit not because I have earned that or proven myself worthy, but simply because of His love for me and His inclusion in all that He has done, then I am free to enjoy my work, to throw myself into what God has given to me, to work hard and to reap the reward of hard work, which is achieving some stuff and seeing some things happen and getting someplace and moving an organization or whatever it is that you do. But it's only when we have that sense of significance and worth and value before we come into work that we'll find that freedom. Think for a moment about Jesus. We believe that Jesus started His ministry around age 30 and that His father was a carpenter, and so He probably learned carpentry as a young man. His family wasn't particularly well off, and so we assume that Jesus also worked really long hours. Now, I want you to imagine Jesus joining your workforce. He joins your industry. He works with cars, or he's a teacher, or he's an accountant, or he joins your team. Tell me, what sort of a worker is Jesus? It's probably not slack. I can't picture Jesus the slacker. Can you? I mean, he would have been good fun at morning tea, I imagine, right? But, you know, I can't imagine Jesus being slack in his work. I think that he would probably work pretty hard. I think he'd be a good worker. I think he'd probably accept correction if he happened to do something wrong, which is probably a theological problem in and of itself, but you know what I'm saying. He said, that's not how we do things around here, Lord. You need to do it a little bit differently. I think he would have been open to hear that instruction. You know what I'm saying? Like, Jesus would have been a good worker. But I cannot imagine Jesus the workaholic. Like, I just can't. Jesus, why are you here so late? Oh, because I have this deep-rooted shame and anxiety that I'm not good enough if I don't finish my task. Okay, I can't picture that. Jesus seems to me to be the sort of person who, in all areas of life, exhibits for us what a restored and renewed life is meant to be like. I think Jesus would have worked hard. I mean, we see it in his ministry. There were times when he was so busy he didn't have time to eat with his disciples. That's busy. He was flat out teaching and working with the crowds and teaching his disciples and all the things that he was on about. He worked hard, but I don't think he ever got lost in that. I don't think he ever forgot his identity as the Son of God who had been invited into a very particular opportunity to participate with what God was doing to restore the world. And that is what he then invites us into. What are you running from over what are you living for? If we put something a little bit better in the denominator, so instead of, instead of saying I'm living for success or achievement or value or worth, let's say I put my family in there. That's a good answer, isn't it? Right? What are you living for? I'm living for my family. Now, the problem, of course, is that many people would say that they do live for their family. Many workaholics would say they work for their family, wouldn't they? So putting my family in the bottom line isn't actually enough, is it? Because what can tend to happen is I'm living for my family and I'm showing it to them by never spending any time with them. Now, we never say that out loud, because if we did, I think we'd hear ourselves and go, oh, that doesn't sound right at all. So if we put, as I would like to think that we would, that we are living for God, I assume that if you're here this morning, you are either exploring what that means or you're committed to that. It's not enough to put it there, is it? I can say I'm living for my family as much as I like. How are you going to know that that's true if my behavior changes? And you know what's really going to change my behavior? It's not if I'm living for my family, it's if I love my family. As my love for my family grows, what is that going to do? As my love for my family grows, it's going to reinforce for me that my value to them is not because I work hard, but because I'm a husband and I'm a father. And I take that significance with me to work, which reduces the fears that I have that I may not be enough. I was a husband before I was a worker, at least here, right? It's only as that my love for my family grows that I will have perhaps the courage not to check my emails 17 times on Saturday. It's only as my love for my family grows that I might be willing to stop thinking about work all the time and instead spend time focusing on them. And I think it's the same with God. It's not just saying that we live for God, that we are living for Him and we want to be involved in what He's doing and all that sort of stuff. It comes down to, I think, a question of, do we love God? Because when we love God, we love Him because He first loved us. We love Him because of what He has done for us, of how He has lent towards us in Christ. And in so doing, we reinforce our identity as daughters and sons of God rather than as workers, which opens us to the possibility of really throwing ourselves into our work without getting lost in it. And isn't that, or doesn't that sound like wisdom? So I don't know, I still haven't asked for a show of hands, and I'm not going to. But if you identify with any of those characteristics of workaholism, if you thought to yourself, yeah, there might be something in that for me this morning, here's your challenge. To spend some time this week investing in your relationship with God. Because that's one of the ways in which we both demonstrate our love for Him and develop that relationship. Because that's how we develop relationships with other people too. Because I don't know about you, but if I have a very busy week or a very busy day, guess what falls off my schedule? It's time with God. I mean, He'll always be there, so I can get back to that later, right? But I've really got to get through my to-do list because it's for today. And if that happens for me, I'm assuming it probably happens for you too. Because the temptations in work are the same regardless of the task or occupation that you have set your hands to. So can I suggest, and here's for extra credit, if you normally work like 12 hours, don't get up a half hour earlier and give that half hour to God. Take a half hour out of the day that you would have spent working and give that to God. Work 11 and a half hours, not 12. Work 10 instead of 10 and a half. And give that half hour to God. Give Him something valuable. Give Him some time that matters. Pray. Be in the Word. Listen to what He might have to say to you. Just spend time with the Lord. Because as our love for the Lord increases, then it's going to shrink the things that we are running from, because our identity is secure in Him. And the behaviors that so often drive us to get lost in our work will diminish. And that's the kind of life that I think will invite people to want to know more about that Jesus we follow. Wouldn't it be a really appealing lifestyle if people knew that you and I could really enjoy our work, could throw ourselves into it, but not get lost? As Paul says to the Colossians, chapter 3, verse 23, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord.
In a society where long hours seem to be pretty normal, and where too many people seem to be lost in some form of workaholism, we need a better theology of work. One that allows us to work hard, enjoy our tasks when we can, but not get lost in them. For those of us who follow Jesus, it begins with living for Him and increasing our love for Him. Is there someone you know who needs to hear this message too? If so, why not share it with them and see what God does through that? As always, we'd love to hear from you as you hear and respond to the invitation of God. You can find us on Facebook or visit our website at gamiabaptist.org.au. God bless.